It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use, and I certainly hope that you have a pencil and paper handy because there might be something you want to make note of. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter, Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, March 9th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. We will return to the sand hills of Quail Hollow Ranch and continue our broom bashing efforts, removing the invasive non-native French broom while helping to restore this unique habitat. Ann and Chuck will be leading the effort this Saturday. Linda won't be there, so come on out and show your support. How to get to Quail Hollow? Well, head up Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz, come down into Felton, turn right at the light onto East Ziani Road, up 2 miles, turn left on Quail Hollow, the park entrance on the right about a half mile up, meet in the gravel parking lot on the left-hand side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitats in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It's probably going to clear up by Saturday, but if things get unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Do bring your gloves and some water. If you have to ask questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. Or email to redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net. Or visit their website at www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. And Snapshot Day cometh. We're gearing up for the 14th annual Central Coast Regional Snapshot Day event. And so keep Saturday, March 4th, 2013, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. clear on your calendar. The Monterey Bay Marine National Sanctuary and the Coastal Watershed Council will systematically sample streams along 300 miles of Central Coast, California. We're organizing teams to monitor sites in Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary will organize teams for Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties. They'll collect water data such as pH, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, and transparency. They'll also collect water samples for laboratory analysis of bacteria and nutrients like nitrate and orthophosphate. And trainings? Well, you might want to get trained. In Santa Cruz, it's going to be April 27th from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, or from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m., both of those classes at the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A. In San Mateo, it'll be Monday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the San Gregorio General Store at the corner of Highway 84 and Old Stage Road. Monterey, the training will be on Sunday, April 28th, from 10:30 in the morning until 12:30 in the afternoon at the REI store on General Stillwell Drive in Monterey. Actually, I believe that's in Seaside or Marina. No, it's in Marina. That's right. And San Luis Obispo, the training will be Tuesday, April 30th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Coastal Discovery Center, Hearst State Beach, San Simeon. And if you need more information, go to www.coastal-watershed.org. That's coastal-watershed.org. And make sure that you're available on Sunday, May 4th, for the actual snapshot day. Moving down under, an Australian tree sitter has ended her 15-month protest because of wildfire. In this story, combined by BBC News and The Telegraph. An anti-logging campaigner in Australia who spent 15 months living up a tree has been forced down by bushfire. Miranda Gibson, 31 years old, took to a makeshift platform atop a 400-year-old eucalyptus tree 60 meters, that's about 200 feet above the ground, in Tasmania in December of 2011. The teacher, who was protesting against logging of native high conservation value Tasmanian forests, has vowed to continue her campaign. She had decided to come down after police and her support crew warned her about the dangers posed by an uncontrolled brush fire only a few kilometers away. Any change of wind could bring it this way quite rapidly, quicker than I'd have time to escape, she told reporters. That was basically the reason for having to make the hard decision, but obviously I have to prioritize safety and not putting myself or anyone else at risk. It is disappointing to come down under these circumstances, Ms. Gibson said. However, I believe what I have achieved throughout being there over a year has been absolutely remarkable. She said she would continue to highlight the plight of Tasmania's forests. In addition to isolation and solitude, she would have to fight the effects of the harsh Tasmanian winter, the BBC's Paul Mercer in Sydney reports. Ms. Gibson said her life was made bearable by solar-powered satellite technology, which she used to address environmental conferences from the tree. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Since our last update, 17 more wild buffalo, mostly mature bulls and pregnant cows, were killed by Nez Perce and Umatilla Treaty hunters, all within 3 days. The majority were killed at the very edge of Yellowstone National Park in Beatty Gulch, the place we now call the Killing Fields. The ravens and eagles have had their fill of the gut piles, to be sure. The buffalo have had more than their fill of loss of family, of human intolerance and disrespect, and they made it clear they would not stand idly by while state, federal, and tribal entities planned their capture and slaughter while simultaneously gunning them down at the park border. Hundreds of wild buffalo had been inhabiting the lands made newly available to them in the Gardner Basin north of Yellowstone National Park. While no hunters were in town, buffalo simply lived their lives, enjoying a little extra room and mourning the relatives they had recently lost to hunters. On Thursday, Yellowstone officials posted closure notices around the Stevens Creek bison trap, making clear their plans to soon start capturing and slaughtering buffalo. A stir of unease filled the air, and the buffalo felt it more than any of us. On Friday morning, after 7 buffalo had been shot at Beatty Gulch, hundreds of wild buffalo responded. It was late morning. Our hearts were heavy with the deaths of the buffalo we had just witnessed and the wakes we had seen just days before. We were high in the hills above the gate to Yellowstone, looking through scopes and binoculars to locate other buffalo. Then it began. At first, we saw a fairly large group running full tilt towards the south for over 10 miles as the road goes, away from hunters and away from the trap. As we watched, the buffalo just kept coming. By the hundreds, they ran wild and free away from certain death and capture. As we counted them, more arrived as if word had gotten out. Death and danger to the north. Buffalo are wise beings, and we have no doubt that they sensed the fate that awaited them there. More than 450 wild buffalo, all but a few small scattered groups, promptly fleeing the landscape where they were vulnerable. On this day, the buffalo saved themselves. The Buffalo Field Campaign's wish list featured item for this week, bikes and bike tools. In the springtime, government agents have hazed buffalo down miles of Forest Service roads that are not yet open to cars, but are open to bikes. Even when cars are allowed, Buffalo Field Campaign volunteers use mountain bikes to keep up and document hazing operations on Forest Service and private lands. Help us get our bicycle fleet ready for spring by donating bikes and tools. Tools we especially need include a work stand, floor pump, headset wrenches, pedal wrenches, crank pullers, cable cutters, cassette and freewheel tools, cone wrenches, chain lube, chain brushes, and 26-inch tubes. For more information about Buffalo Field Campaign needs, please visit their website. And here it is, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And they do have a more extensive wish list there, but when you get all that stuff, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. The zip code is 59758. And if you have any questions, give them a call, area code 406-646-0070. Once again, the webpage for all this information and more, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And mountain lion protections have been strengthened in California. The story reported by Layla Kearney, editing by Steve Gorman and Xavier Briand of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. California wildlife officials have adopted new rules aimed at protecting the public from mountain lions without resorting to killing so many of the big cats so often when they roam near humans, pets, or livestock. Mountain lions, also known as cougars, are classified as a specially protected species in California under a ballot measure that made it illegal to hunt, harm, capture, or harass them. The law, however, allows them to be killed by special permit when they are deemed to pose a threat to public safety, livestock, or other wildlife that are protected as endangered species, such as bighorn sheep. Under revised regulations issued last Friday by the State Fish and Wildlife Department, property owners and law enforcement officers seeking to protect people, pets, or livestock from cougars may kill only one mountain lion with each permit. The new rules stem from several controversial killings at the end of 2012, including two separate cases in which a single permit was used in the killing of four cougars. In a third incident that drew an outcry from animal rights advocates, authorities responded to reports of mountain lions under a home in the coastal town of Half Moon Bay, where they killed two cougar cubs weighing less than 14 pounds each. The death of the two cubs last year also has prompted legislation that would allow authorities to tranquilize, transport, and rehabilitate cougars, which California law currently restricts. In addition to restricted killings, the new rules provide game officials and law enforcement with greater flexibility in dealing with cougars found lurking in populated areas. In the past, authorities had just two options: to monitor a mountain lion until it left the area on its own, or kill it. The updated rules allow for a third way, the use of non-lethal ammunition such as pellets or beanbag rounds, to drive cats back into the wild. The department also plans to provide additional training on harmless methods of frightening cougars away from populated areas. This will increase available options for addressing potentially dangerous but ambiguous encounters, agency spokesperson Jordan Traverso said. An estimated 4,000 to 5,000 mountain lions inhabit California lands, and the animals range over roughly half the state's territory, frequently putting them in close proximity to people in foothill and mountain areas. Wildlife Agency predicts an increase in mountain lion encounters with people as human development expands into more of the cougar's natural habitat. But it doesn't have to. And an average of 156 special permits are issued annually between the year 2005 and 2009, with an average of 73 cougars killed each year during that period, according to the latest available Fish and Wildlife Department data. Tim Dunbar, executive director of the Mountain Lion Foundation, a Sacramento-based advocacy group for cougars, called the new rules a first good step in bolstering protection of the animal. Here are Representative McClintock's latest moves on the Merced River in this story by Friends of the River. And you can find more information about it at www.for.org. The opening battle for the integrity of the National Wild and Scenic River System in the 113th Congress began on March 4th with the introduction of H.R. 934 by Representative Tom McClintock of Elk Grove. Like its predecessor, H.R. 2578, in the previous Congress, H.R. 934 would de-designate a portion of the Merced River to accommodate an expanded McClure Reservoir. In his press release announcing the bill, Representative McClintock characterized the National Wild and Scenic River System, our nation's premier tool for preserving our natural river heritage, as just truly outrageous bureaucratic red tape. The bill introduction was quickly followed by another Modesto B editorial in favor of de-designating the Merced because, to borrow again from Representative McClintock, it represented a, quote, desperately needed resource, and that de-designating a national wild and scenic river to replace free-flowing water with a reservoir for the first time in our nation's history does not represent a dangerous precedent to other rivers in the system. Because of this, the Merced Irrigation District needs to be free to study raising their dam. The Merced River is already extensively exploited. The new yield potential available from the proposed raising of the dam is just 2.5% of what the district typically diverts into its canals, and that doesn't even take into account its waters diverted downstream of its confluence with the San Joaquin. Exchequer Dam has never spilled over its ungated spillway. With full reservoirs, 32 miles of the Merced River already lie beneath the Merced Irrigation District and PG&E reservoirs. And in a long series of its annual reports at the time of the wild and scenic designation, the district asserted, "The district now has virtual control of the waters of the Merced as long as such waters are put to beneficial use, and it is assured of an adequate irrigation supply for the foreseeable future." And yes, they also sell water to Westside out-of-district farmers every chance they get. Nothing in the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act prevents the district from studying raising the dam. When they do, they will discover some inconvenient facts. Their plan could result in a collapse of their dam and could never pass a dam safety review, or that their costs will also include raising the Highway 49 bridge and dealing with their dam safety problems, costs that far exceed the initial estimates they tout to the Modesto Bee, and that maybe expanding the reservoir is impermissible under state law protecting the fully protected Merced River limestone salamander, a creature found nowhere else on Earth. And that's just the problems they will have with the state of California. The bill's authors can't seem to stay on the, quote, "don't worry, this won't ever happen again" message that the Modesto Bee is touting. Last year, Representative Denham, author of H.R. 2578, informed his congressional colleagues that, quote, "we should be able to adjust those boundaries, especially if it serves a greater good," unquote, while at the same time saying, "we need many more projects like this." Maybe not exactly on message, huh? And Representative McClintock has never seen a dam proposal he didn't like. He's trying to hold flood control projects for the state capital hostage for the Auburn Dam, and he recently told a crowd in Sonora when asked about the twin tunnel proposal to deliver water to Westside farms in the southern state. He said, quote, "I've taken a strong stand in Washington, no additional conveyance without additional storage. This business of sucking this region dry of water without producing additional water supplies for this region is an absolute outrage. All that does is transfer a water shortage from Southern California to Northern California, and by God, that's not going to happen," unquote. Good rhetoric for a new Northern California congressman from Southern California. He's probably right to be concerned about the tunnels, but what's all this business about new storage? Could it mean a new dam, reservoir, or diversion is coming to a river near you if McClintock has his way? And is the National Wild and Scenic Rivers system just a, quote, "truly outrageous bureaucratic red tape," as Representative McClintock says? And should we really accept the Modesto Bee's assurances that breaking the permanent in permanent protection would not jeopardize the system when the list of co-sponsors includes the majority whip of the House of Representatives? The Modesto Bee seems a little short on evidence. You might want to write and tell them to check out the Friends of the River website. That is FOR.org. If you wanted to send a letter to the Modesto Bee, send it to letters@modbee.com. That's letters@modbee.com. And do remember, your letter should be limited to 200 words. Moving north, Save Waldo Lake in Oregon, Act 2. The Oregon State Aviation's board public hearing on January 31st confirmed the public's desire for a complete gasoline motor ban, including seaplanes, for pristine Waldo Lake in the Cascade Range in Oregon. Oregon Wild supporters alone sent in over 1,260 letters to the Aviation Board to that effect. "Thank you all for standing up for this gem of the Cascades," and read Oregon Wild's official comments on the Aviation Board's proposed permanent rule on the Oregon Wild website. I'll give you that in just a minute. It's pretty easy. It's OregonWild.org. Unfortunately, the fight's not over yet, and Waldo Lake still needs your help to defend its clear, quiet waters. On March 13th at 3 p.m. in Salem, Oregon, the Oregon State Environmental Committee will hold a public hearing regarding Senate Bill 602, which would permanently ban seaplanes and motorboats from Waldo Lake. Once again, that's March 13th at 3 p.m. in Salem, Oregon. Doesn't say where, but it is the Oregon State Environment Committee. I believe the state capitol is pretty small, so we urge anyone able to attend the March 13th hearing to go and make visible the public interest in keeping Waldo Lake pristine. Oh, here it is. The specific location of the hearing has yet to be announced, but stay tuned for additional details. You're probably going to have to contact Oregon Wild. I won't have time to do that before the meeting. If you'd like to learn more about the history of Waldo Lake and what's it at stake, visit the Oregon Wild website. And once again, that's www.oregonwild.org. And Oregon Wild is all one word. Let's turn to Wilderness Watch and hear some news from them. The Forest Service had dropped a plan for helicopter use in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. On February 22nd, the Forest Service withdrew its decision to use a helicopter to replace the bridge over Running Creek in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness in Idaho. The action was taken in response to an administrative appeal filed by Wilderness Watch and Friends of the Clearwater. Rather than using a helicopter to haul in pre-assembled bridge stringers, the Forest Service agreed to use a packable design. Wilderness Watch is extremely pleased with the new decision, which will help to keep alive the traditional skills necessary to administrate wilderness without motorized access or equipment. The project will also now serve as a positive example for wilderness stewards elsewhere. And the Forest Service has proposed massive fire breaks in the Ventana Wilderness just south of us here. The U.S. Forest Service has proposed to build 7.5 miles of permanent fire breaks within the Ventana Wilderness in California using chainsaws, heavy equipment, and vehicles. Wilderness Watch is opposing this proposal as a violation of the Wilderness Act, among other things. The issue is complicated by a series of special provisions that Congress added to laws that expanded the Ventana Wilderness over time. These special provisions authorized the use of pre-suppression work within the Ventana additions, but none authorized chainsaws, heavy vehicles, or permanent 150-foot-wide firebreaks within an area that is supposed to remain untrammeled by man. And Wilderness Watch is opposing a BLM plan to allow the University of Wyoming to use helicopters to fly students and materials in and out of the Chemehuevi Mountains Wilderness in California. The students would study the Chemehuevi Mountains fault system over a 3-year period. The Bureau of Land Management presented this proposal for public comment at the end of January. The Wilderness Act expressly prohibits the landing of helicopters in wilderness, but the BLM felt that the reference to scientific uses in the so-called public purposes section of that law gives the agency permission to approve the project. And just north of here, the Drake's Bay Oyster Company has gained a temporary reprieve. As we reported in January, the Drake's Bay Oyster Company had requested a preliminary injunction to allow its operation to continue at Drake's Estero in the Philip Burton Wilderness in California while its lawsuit is heard. Earlier this month, Federal Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California denied the injunction, deciding the courts don't have jurisdiction to overrule the Secretary's decision. Judge Gonzalez-Rogers also invoked a 1976 Point Reyes Wilderness Act, which designated Drake's Estero as potential wilderness and gave the Secretary of Interior the power to decide when the potential wilderness would become designated wilderness. The Drake's Bay Oyster Company appealed that decision, and on February 26th, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals granted the Oyster Company an emergency motion that will allow the commercial operation to remain open until its hearing in May. Drake's Bay Oyster Company is also facing a cease and desist order from the California Coastal Commission last month based on numerous infractions of environmental and other rules. And for information about this and other wilderness issues, go to www.wildernesswatch.org. And over in England, deer numbers are spiraling out of control, scientists say, in this story reported by Nina Chesney, with editing by John Hemming of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. Current efforts to control Britain's increasing deer numbers are not enough to stop populations spreading out of control, research by the University of East Anglia showed recently. There are now more deer in Britain than in any time since the Ice Age, scientists say. Without natural predators, populations are continuing to rise, causing a serious threat to biodiversity. High numbers of deer can threaten woodland birds, carry infections such as Lyme disease, damage crops, and cause road traffic accidents. Maybe they need some wolves, huh? Maybe we could send them a wolf or two. The research team studied the numbers, sex ratio, and fertility of roe and muntjac deer across 234 kilometers of forested, that's square kilometers of forested land and heathland in Breckland, East Anglia, to measure the effectiveness of deer management. The team found that while deer management appeared to control numbers at a stable level, it was only because thousands of deer were pushed out to the surrounding countryside each year, helping to drive further spread of the animals. In the Breckland area study, 53% of the muntjac from an estimated population need to be culled, and 60% of roe deer just to offset reproduction, the scientists said. These figures exceed previous cull recommendations of 30% for the muntjac and 20% for the roe deer. Even higher numbers could need to be culled if populations are to be reduced, scientists added. Native deer are an important part of our wildlife that add beauty and excitement to the countryside, but left unchecked, they threaten our woodland biodiversity, said Kristen Weber, who conducted the study while a postgraduate student at the University of East Anglia. Trying to control deer without a robust understanding of their true numbers can be like sleepwalking into disaster. To effectively reduce and stabilize the population, establishing numbers is vital, she added. Culling large numbers of animals can be an emotional issue in Britain, which sees itself as a nation of animal lovers. The British government was considering a badger cull last year to stop the spread of tuberculosis, in cattle, but delayed that plan due to public opposition. Critics said the cull would be ineffective, and public opposition was widespread, with more than 150,000 people signing an online protest initiated by former Queen guitarist Brian May. And in biological diversity news, Arctic ice seals have won protection in a much-needed win for Arctic animals. The Center for Biological Diversity's petition to the government has protected ringed and bearded seals under the Endangered Species Act. They're the first species since polar bears to get federal safeguards because global warming is melting their sea ice home. Bearded seals with their thick beard-like whiskers need the ice to give birth and raise their pups. Ringed seals build snow caves in the ice to keep their pups warm and safe from predators. As the Arctic ice melts, the pup shelters can collapse and kill them. Arctic summer sea ice fell to half its average size in 2012, and the ringed and bearded seals' winter sea ice habitat in Alaska's Bering Sea is projected to decline at least 40% by the year 2050, boding ill for these endearing, unique creatures. Endangered Species Act protection is urgently needed to help them survive. And a rare southwestern bird gets 200,000 protected acres. The federal government has set aside 208,973 acres as protected critical habitat for the endangered southwestern willow flycatcher. These dainty insect-eating birds, whose scientific name partly means mosquito king, are sadly kings no more of their riverine habitats, of which 90% have been gobbled up or ruined by dams, water withdrawal, livestock grazing, and urban sprawl. Flycatchers were one of the first animals the Center for Biological Diversity ever worked to save, petitioning for the species with our allies in 1992 and winning Endangered Species Act protection in 1995. But despite decades of center work, the flycatcher has never before been granted adequate critical habitat. Now it will be protected along 1,227 miles of rivers in six states, including California, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Nevada. And a lawsuit has sought protection for the loggerhead sea turtle habitat. Center for Biological Diversity and other groups filed suit against two federal agencies for failing to protect critical habitat for loggerhead sea turtles along the west and east coasts. The ancient turtles are facing threats from fisheries, climate change, and coastal development. Their most important nesting beaches and ocean waters need help. In Mexico alone, 1,000 loggerheads are estimated to die each year from gillnet fishing, 400 washed ashore dead last summer. And with sea levels projected to rise by at least 3 to 6 feet in 2100, key nesting habitat on vulnerable beaches will be flooded. Critical habitat protection would help safeguard marine and terrestrial areas essential for migrating, feeding, and egg layings. The impacts of Hurricane Sandy and Tropical Storm Debbie have made clear that healthy coastal beaches are important for both humans and for nesting sea turtles, said Jacqueline Lopez, the Center for Biological Diversity's Florida attorney. And you can find out more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. Tune in next week at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM for another Earth First Update. You can also hear the Earth First Update on Radio Free Moscow, Idaho at 92.5 FM on Monday nights at 9:30. We thank you for carrying our program. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week.